OEA. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. We will complete the argument of these causes before our lunch break and take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. In the order in which these causes will be presented, they are as follows. Liberty Mutual Insurance Company and Robert G. Garrett versus Garrison Constructors Incorporated from Ector County. Christina Michelle Brown and others versus Calvin J. Sharks, M.D. and others from Navarro County. Vincent A. Brown versus the Bank of Galveston from Galveston County. And Jay Hudson and Richard Stephen Schluter versus Karen Sue Schluter from Travis County. The arguments are being recorded by the court, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments from the clerk of our court if you so desire. The court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Liberty Mutual versus Garrison.
May it please the court, Attorney Neil Rammond will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Robert Garrett, an individual, and his employer, Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. This dispute began when Liberty Mutual filed suit against its insured Garrison Contractors in order to recover unpaid premium under a retrospective premium insurance plan. Garrison not only filed an answer, but at the same time filed counterclaims against Liberty Mutual Insurance Company and third-party claims against the Liberty Mutual employee, Mr. Robert Garrett. The trial court first granted summary judgment on behalf of Liberty Mutual and Mr. Garrett as to all of the counterclaims and as to the third-party action. The trial court subsequently granted a summary judgment on behalf of Liberty Mutual on its affirmative claims for the unpaid retrospective premium. This is an appeal from a decision by the El Paso Court of Appeals, which reversed part of the summary judgment on behalf of Mr. Garrett and Liberty Mutual as to the counterclaims and the third-party action. Although it did affirm the summary judgment as to some of the claims, the Court of Appeals also reversed the summary judgment on behalf of Liberty Mutual for its affirmative claims for the unpaid premium. Now, we would like to first address the issue as to whether or not the employee of Liberty Mutual, Mr. Robert Garrett, can be individually liable for a claim under Section 16 of Article 21 of the Texas Insurance Code. Now, in analyzing that issue, it's important to remember that at all times relevant to this lawsuit, Mr. Garrett was an employee of Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, acting in the course and scope of his employment. He was not an independent agent. He was not an independent business entity, but at all times he was acting within the course and scope of his employment for the insurance company. Now, in rejecting or reversing the summary judgment on those claims as to Mr. Garrett, the Court of Appeals in El Paso, Justice Larson writing the opinion, specifically looked at the sections under Article 2121 and simplistically concluded that because Section 16 provides for a claim against any person engaged in prohibited practices, and because Section 2, in its definition of persons, makes reference to agents, concluded that as because Mr. Garrett is a person, then he must be subject to liability for a Section 16 21.21 claim. Now, I should also draw the court's attention to the fact that in preparing for this oral argument, we ran across a second Court of Appeals opinion which does simplistically and briefly address this issue as well, which is not referenced in the briefs of any of the parties to this case, nor in the amicus briefs that have been filed, but I do believe I should bring it to your attention. The Texarkana Court of Appeals, in an analysis lasting only 14 words in one sentence, summarily also concluded simplistically that because the insurance company employee was a person, then he was subject to liability under the insurance code. And if you want to make note of that case, it's the Southland Lloyds Insurance Company versus Tomberlane case, which is at 919 Southwest 2nd, 822.
What's the written history on that?
It is a writ denied, Your Honor. And we do not know whether that issue was presented to this court when the court denied writ on that opinion. Now, we would submit that both courts of appeals are incorrect with their simplistic analysis of the statute. and would argue that their decisions are inconsistent with this court's ruling in Allstate versus Watson and inconsistent with the statutory scheme set forth in Article 21.21. Now, going back specifically to the Allstate versus Watson case, in that opinion, this court rejected the argument that the term person, or quote, any person, gives a stranger to the insurance contract a cause of action under the statute. Rather, in that opinion, this court held that the obligations imposed by Article 21.21 are engrafted onto the contract between the insurer and the insured and are extra contractual in nature. Given the fact that those obligations are purely extra contractual in nature, those obligations cannot be imposed on Mr. Bob Garrett, who was not a party to the insurance contract in any form or fashion. Mr. Garrett is not an insurance company. He is not a business entity in any form or fashion. Rather, he is simply an individual acting on behalf of the insurance company and is no part or part is not a party to the insurance contract. Now, secondly, we would argue that to impose individual liability on Mr. Garrett would be inconsistent with the overall statutory scheme of Article 21.21. When you look specifically at Section 16, it refers to liability being imposed on persons engaged in the unlawful acts or practices. But when you look at Section 2, in order to determine the definition of person, the courts of appeals have ignored the fact that a crucial part of that definition is the term engaged in the business of insurance. In other words, when it defines the term person, it speaks about individuals or partnerships or companies that are, quote, engaged in the business of insurance. Now, that clause modifies the universe of people or entities that can be, that are persons under the statute. That phrase has meaning, and it is a modifier of the types of individuals or entities that can be persons under the statute. This court recognized the significance of that phrase, and that when analyzing who can be a defendant under an Article 21.21 Section 16 claim, this court specifically gave legal significance to that phrase when it held in the Great American Insurance Company versus North Austin MUD number 1 case that a surety company cannot be a defendant or liable under Article 21.21 Section 16 because a surety company is not engaged in the business of insurance. Similarly, the Court of Appeals in Dallas in the McCain versus NME hospital case was confronted with a claim in which certain attorneys were alleged to have conspired with their insurance company clients to deprive a plaintiff of their insurance benefits and to misrepresent the nature of those insurance benefits.
Let me ask you a couple of questions along these lines. Aren't adjusters frequently employees of insurance companies?
They are, Your Honor, but they are not always.
But they can be, and in fact, frequently are.
Yes.
And what about life insurance counselors? Would they not be typically employees of insurance companies?
Now, that I'm not sure. Life insurance counselors sometimes, I don't know whether the financial planners would fall in that category, but certainly they are times employees of insurance companies.
Okay. Looking at Section 2, I'm sure you're familiar with it, it says that any other legal entity engaged in the business of insurance, including agents, brokers, adjusters. So are you saying that we are to read adjusters in the definition of person to be involved in the business of insurance such that they can be held independently liable only when they are acting not in the capacity of an employee for an insurance company, but in their capacity as, let's say, an independent entrepreneur, sole proprietor, or something like that?
That's correct. In other words, they have to be a party to a contract. If the insurance adjuster is an employee of an insurance company, they are not subject to personal or individual liability under the statute.
Well, you said something I think new here, and that is, so you're saying that the standard should be whether or not the party is a party to a contract should be the test.
At the very least, because of the Allstate versus Watson decision, which says that these obligations under Article 21.21 are extra contractual in nature and are engrafted into the contract itself. So there has to at least be a contractual relationship. Now, that can sometimes occur, meaning an agent can be, an adjuster or a broker or whatever can be outside the insurance company in business as a sole proprietor. This court doesn't have to address that question here as to whether in the sole proprietorship that agent would be liable under the insurance code. It may well be. All that this court has to decide in this particular case is whether that agent or broker or adjuster in its status as an employee of the insurance company has individual liability.
And in your view, no such employee could ever have that liability?
An employee, under the insurance code, yes, yes. Your Honor.
And although you think it's a field, if there were three or four principals, say, in an insurance agency, what would your analysis of that situation be?
If it's a sole proprietorship, if they are owners of the business so that they are, in essence, the party with whom the individual or the claimant has a contractual relationship, then, once again, I don't know that we have to answer that question today, but certainly what we're saying is that at the very least, there has to be that contractual relationship. If it was an Alexander insurance agency or an independent agency with principals and there was a contractual relationship, then this court might find Article 21.21 applies. But we don't have to answer that question today. What we simply have to say today is that an employee of the insurance company is not individually liable. Now, I would remind the court that the term business engaged in the business of insurance is a phrase that is prevalent within the statutory scheme of Article 21.21. When you look specifically at Section 1A, which defines the purpose of Article 21.21, it speaks in terms of regulating the trade in the business of insurance. In Section 4, which is the part of Article 21.21 which defines the unfair methods of competition, it speaks in terms of the unfair methods of competition in the business of insurance.
Mr. Ammon, in the Watson case, the court was concerned about potential conflicting duties by the insurance company, a duty to the insured to treat the insured fairly, and a potential duty under the insurance code requiring the insurance company to have some sort of extra contractual duty to the third party, the injured person, creating a conflict between their duty to represent their insured and be nice to the injured party. What would be inconsistent here with a duty against an employee to honor Article 21.21 that would be inconsistent with the employee's duty to its own business to comply with Article 21.21?
I am not prepared to articulate any of those inconsistencies, Your Honor. In fact, part of our argument, to skip forward just a minute, is that the addition of individual liability on behalf of Mr. Garrett in this particular circumstance, for example, is an unnecessary remedy and adds nothing to the claims that the Garrison Contractors Group has. It provides them no additional remedy nor no additional protections because, as this court held in the Nativi-Dodd decision, the buck stops with the insurance companies because they have an obligation to regulate what their agents and servants and employees do. But this court held on page 700 of that opinion that because the buck stops with the insurance company, in rejecting the application of the common law duty of good faith and fair dealing to insurance companies, the court held that, to individual contractors and agents or of the insurance companies, this court held there is no need to extend that duty to include agents or contractors of the insurance carriers because the insurance carriers are liable for the actions of their agents.
Would that change if the carrier was insolvent?
Well, Your Honor, it depends on the status of that insolvency, and yes, I can understand that in an insolvency situation, that might be the case. It certainly is not the case here with Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, which we've established in the record had close to $4 billion in policyholder surplus. And this court has certainly indicated that that concern is not significant enough in this kind of situation when it held in that decision that the insurance companies, because of their ability to regulate their employees, are sufficient enough to stand behind what their employees do and to regulate their conduct. And certainly the insurance companies, to answer your question, to get back to that, is that the insurance companies have an obligation to regulate their employees and to make sure they comply with the unfair practices requirements of the insurance code. and that is a sufficient regulatory requirement upon the individual, but I don't see that kind of conflict that you're talking about, because indeed they will be, they have an incentive to control their employees and to make sure they comply with the statute.
Under the common law, an employee or an agent may be liable for fraud done on the principal's behalf. Why isn't that an analogy for liability here?
Well, what we're saying is that this court, under this particular case, is obligated to construe what the legislature meant when it enacted this particular statute. And whereas a common law cause of action might exist, given the phraseology of the statute, which talks about being in the business of insurance, given this court's conclusion that the obligation here under Article 2121 is set forth in Allstate versus Watson is one that's purely extra contractual in nature and not a common law tort duty or obligation, then consistent with that, it should apply only to those entities that are parties to contracts. Now, in my limited time, I would also point the court to Section 23 of Article 2121, which further demonstrates the legislature's intent that individuals not be personally liable. Because in Article 23, the legislature addresses the question of how civil penalties or judgments or awards are to be funded. Those judgments that are obtained under Article 21.21, how are they to be funded? And it's simply out of the capital or surplus of offending insurance companies, not individuals.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Good morning, Your Honors. Let me first bring the court's attention to the handout which has been before the court during the course of the argument. I think it's very significant because, as counsel agreed, this is a statutory construction issue. There are analogs in common law. There are policy considerations that always can be taken into account, but as this court has recognized, when it's faced with the plain meaning of the statute, unless there's, as Justice Enoch pointed out earlier, a huge countervailing consideration about conflicting duties that make the statute unworkable in this context, then the plain meaning of the statute ought to be applied, especially when it does fulfill the policy of making sure that the marketplace is rid of unfair and deceptive practices in the business of insurance.
Can we harmonize your position with Section 23?
Yes, I believe we can, Your Honor, and I'll tell you how that happened. I mean, this is one area of the law that I haven't had to research. I happen to have lived it because I've been involved in each of the legislative sessions. When the Act was first passed, the Section 16 of 2121, by the way, the Act was back in 1957, but it did not get its private remedy of Section 16 until 1973, when this was passed as part of the package that also passed the DTPA. At that time, the Section 23, along with Section 16, as it was first enacted, provided for only liability against companies. As a matter of fact, that's what I was about to bring to the court's attention, is that in 85, that language, may bring an action against the company or companies engaged in such practices, was taken out, and the word person or persons was put in, and the statutory definition of persons was completely reenacted without change. They did not go back and amend Section 23. So if you do have a judgment against a company, which obviously is among the persons that can be sued, then that will be only obtainable according to the calculation and limits of Section 23. But there is no, and again, the fact that Section 23 speaks of reserves, which is only true of insurance companies, cannot be squared with a broad definition of person, which does cover agents and solicitors and individuals who don't have reserves.
I mean, how does that work? You say that if a judgment is rendered against the individual, that you can only satisfy that judgment?
What I've said is that if you have a judgment against, in this case, Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, then obviously Section 23 by its terms would apply because it does have reserves. The statutory formula can be applied, and that particular judgment could only be obtained pursuant to those limitations or paid pursuant to those limitations. Section 23 doesn't apply to people who don't have reserves and don't have the various aspects of that particular statutory formula. Obviously, it applies to individuals. Individuals do not have reserves. It obviously applies to agents. Agents do not have reserves. And so the fact that 23 limits how one particular subclass of defendants may satisfy a judgment doesn't impact on the overall breadth of the statute.
Mr. Maxwell, what would a suit against the individual for individual liability accomplish in a suit for these wrongful acts against a company not accomplish?
Well, Your Honor, you know, I guess it depends on the facts of each particular case. I mean, let me first respond to you from a public policy standpoint.
The facts here where we have a solvent insurance company, not...
Well, in any individual case, whether you do or you do not sue, the individual who actually made the representation to you is the case, is a judgment made by the lawyer in the individual case. I do have Mr. Hudman here, who was counsel below, and maybe that's a question best answered as why he did it in this case. If you're asking why a statute exists that would permit a lawsuit to be brought against an individual.
If the individual is engaged in the business of insurance.
Absolutely, and there's no question this gentleman was.
He was an employee of the company.
Absolutely, but he was engaged in the business of insurance. Section 2102 lists the things that make a person an agent. An agent is anybody who solicits an insurance policy, accepts a premium, delivers a policy. He did all those things.
What about the definition of entity? Entity is not a natural person.
That's an interesting point, Your Honor, but petitioners argue this case as though the word legal entity was the first word in the definition of person and everything else followed thereafter. This statutory definition begins with the word any individual. And then it goes on to list various kinds of insurance companies, and then it has a catch-all at the very end that says any other legal entity involved in the business of insurance. Obviously, individuals are covered. I don't think, I didn't hear counsel argue that individuals are not covered. He tries to draw a distinction between whether or not you're an employee or an independent agent, which I think is totally unworkable. Why should it make any difference whether or not a plaintiff, a defendant, is working for an insurance company or on his own if he violates the law and causes damages? Certainly doesn't make any sense from a regulatory scheme if you're trying to rid the marketplace of wrongful practices. And I'm also a little amused by this rather faithful statement in the petitioner's brief about how they're going to stand up behind their agents and the buck stops there. I happen to be the lawyer that was involved in Selvig Life versus Coates, and I remember a long and drawn-out trial and an appearance before this court where they were contending that they were not responsible for the acts of their agent because they did not specifically authorize him to make the misrepresentations that he made. And so the responsibility of an insurance company for its employee or its outside agents is always hotly contested, and the buck does not stop there.
Either in or out of the scope of employment type of argument when you go
to work.
Doesn't that assume either in or out of the scope of employment when you take that argument to where you want it to go?
Well, if I understand the inquiry, the problem with trying to make a distinction between applying the statute to an individual agent when he is not working for an insurance company and not applying it when he is an employee makes the consumer's ability to recover as well as the overall enforcement scheme of ridding the marketplace of unfair practice hinge on a finding of actual apparent express authority. It doesn't seem to be...
Inquiry is we're here at, do you agree with the issue, is this employee individually liable under the act? That's the narrative.
Absolutely.
And he's an employee.
That's right. And
he was acting within the scope of his employment. Is there any dispute about that?
None that I know of.
Right. So what I'm trying to get to is when they say in a case, whether it's right or wrong, well, we're not liable for his statement because it's, quote, outside the scope of his employment, and try to prove that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't stand behind it if they're found that it was.
Well, what I was bemused by, Justice Baker, was the fact that we have a rather bland statement in the brief that no one has to worry about poor consumers because we're going to stand up behind our agents has to be taken with somewhat of a grain of salt because the authority of the agent to make the representation is highly contested.
Yes,
and I want to bring up the Navitas versus the Lexus case. That was a case involving unfair claim settlement practices. And I believe, Justice Gonzalez, you authored that opinion. You found, and it was obvious to all that were looking at it, that particular tort rested upon a contract. And that there was no contract between the plaintiff and the defendant in that case. That is not the case here. Number one, this is not an unfair claim settlement practices case. We're not talking about the failure of an employee to carry out contractual obligations. We're talking about an employee who made a misrepresentation about the scope of coverage, the very heart of the DTPA, the very heart of Article 21.21. And here, if we need a contract, we have a contract. To be sure, not with the employee directly, but neither did fraud require an individual contract with the offending fraudfeasor employee. So instead of, Justice Enoch, a situation where you have a long-standing practice, which we could debate the wisdom of about no direct actions against insurance companies and conflicting duties, there is no countervailing huge policy consideration that would cause this court not to enforce the plain meaning of the statute.
Well, is there anybody who is employed by an insurance company who would not be subject to liability under the statute?
Well, that's, I guess there's really always two points in a question like that. One is the definition of he who a suit may be brought against broad enough to pick up a lot of people? And the answer to that question is yes, but it's a broad definition. Second part of the question is, can they be held liable? And I think that's where the court properly exercises its control over this statute and makes it a reasonable application is if we look at the individual laundry list sections that are involved and decide whether or not, in this particular case, there was a, quote, making or circulating, and I think that was one of the examples in the brief, making or circulating an advertisement that contains a false or misleading statement concerning insurance.
But how?
Does the laundry list provision itself apply to this fact situation?
So, I mean, if the suit were brought against a lower level, much lower level employee, secretary, but who had considerable responsibility for her boss's business or his boss's business, or there might still be liability in those circumstances.
Well, you know, it's
trying to get a test.
Well, right? I know that, Justice Heck, and I mean, I think you're entirely right about asking the question. It's not a question. I can assure you that question was asked in our offices before I showed up here today.
Mr. Rammond says it's contractual.
What I'm saying is that I am defending the center field today. You know, I may be over here someday on the periphery, but I'm not today. We have an agent who is expressly mentioned in the definition of person who is selling insurance to somebody and making statements about coverage. I mean, what could be so unquestionably within the definition of person? Counsel, my opponent, begged off on a similarly difficult question by saying, well, we don't have to reach that today. Well, certainly we don't.
I pressured him a little bit.
You did. And I think you might be doing that to me now. Let me see here. I think what the legislature did, and I think you can see the wisdom in this, why should we start carving down who is obligated not to lie a priori by restricting the definition of person? And let's leave to the application of the specific prohibitions in the statute to specific facts and determine whether or not this person violated this provision, as opposed to a priori excluding them and allowing them to go and commit whatever act they want and hope that you drew the line appropriately. This is a broad application statute, not unlike the DTPA. And as a matter of fact, another case, and I'm going to supply you a list, but I got in the case late, and there are some other cases that need to be brought to the court's attention, but Lye versus Wilson, Supreme Court case in 1983, that same point was the individual that there was the sole shareholder of a corporation, personally responsible. And Justice Spears, in his concurrence, says that, in referring to an earlier opinion of this court, Carlin Kelly versus McLaren, said that in that case, which had held no liability, that there was no showing that that person had actually committed a deceptive trade practice himself, and said in this case there was. So Lye versus Wilson is at 663-813, and I'll certainly supply that to the court. So
the arguments are that the only reason this is done is for harassment and to avoid removal on the other side, and but you say it is also to root out bad practices.
Absolutely.
Then are there any other considerations, that you know, discovery or any other?
Well,
tactical or
this statute, as well as the DTPA, Your Honor. And of course, there's a general provision in the rules about it, but I believe the DTPA was the forerunner, the first one to ever mention sanctions for bad faith harassment claims, and providing that in the statute of provision. I think later was the model for the court, if I'm not mistaken, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe there are other models that even the DTPA was based upon. So you have that protection. And another thing strikes me, too, and that is that whether or not an individual person is brought into a case or not, there may be tactical considerations. We all know there's another area of the practice of law, but whether or not the federal courts are properly getting enough diversity cases can be the subject of congressional action or the modification of their fraudulent joinder rules. Let me mention a parallel statute. I think it's useful sometimes to say, well, if the legislature intended a narrow class of defendants to be sued, why didn't they say so? And had they said so anyplace else? Well, in the prompt payment of claims statute, 2155 of the insurance code provides squarely that the action is brought only against the insurer. Express limitation of a cause of action on behalf of insurance and policyholders. You know, that's, you must respond with the reasons you're denying the claim and set forth other standards that apply in the settlement of the handling of a claim. The duty is owed only by the insurer.
But no one else can make the prompt payment.
Absolutely. But other people could be involved in the non-payment of it. There's always the notion, Your Honor, that corporations act only through their employees. And like in Natividad, there may be somebody to whom that responsibility has been given that is doing the four-corner passing game and keeping the claim from being paid. But the point of the story is that if it was a remedy provided for unfair claim settlement practice of a specific sort, and it was a remedy limited to an insurance company, my point for bringing it up only is that when the legislature wants to narrow the class of persons against whom a suit can be brought, it has shown itself entirely capable of doing so. And on the other side, this new unfair claim settlement practice list, you know, is, I think, partially in a response to the Watson case of Justice Enoch, the unfair claim settlement practices that were only over in 21-2 were brought over and enacted in 21-21 to remove the notion that you somehow had to reach out and incorporate those. 21-2's regulations, I mean prohibitions now in 21-21, are only available if the claimant is an insured or beneficiary. Again, if there is a desire on behalf of the legislature to narrow the scope either of the claimant or of the defendant, the person to whom the duty is owed or the person who owes the duty, they have shown themselves entirely capable of doing so. And I noticed some of those federal cases that the petitioner cited the cases holding, as Justice Heck said earlier, that an agent can be liable for his own misrepresentation. And one of those cases was the Gross case, another case not cited, and I'll supply them.
There was a fraud claim that the trial court ruled against the plaintiff on. Does it survive on appeal here? Is there contention by the respondent that there's still some error in the fraud ruling?
I don't believe there was a cross application for a bit of error on the fraud point, okay. So the fraud point is not a before court.
And secondly, there's an argument that if there is a remand, it would go as to all the claims. But how does our Bandera decision some months ago impact this case?
You really have, that was it. I'm now down on the floor, flat. I haven't read it, and I don't know. But you know what? I'm going to send you a letter when I get back to the office.
Maxwell, I was not completely clear in your response to Justice Owen's question of how you should harmonize Section 23 with 16, because I can follow your argument, and then we butt head on with 23 that says these penalties shall be paid on the capital or surplus funds of the offending insurance company. I'm still having difficulty reconciling that.
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, I'm trying to give you what really happened with this statute. It helps to look, at least put it in context. At one time, the case could only be brought against a company or companies. That was changed in 85. 23 was unchanged. How do you harmonize them? Do you take 23, which says that if a suit is against an insurance company, it can only be taken out of their, and I haven't really read it that close, against its reserves, and say that they're
only from the capital or surplus funds of the offending insurance company.
Absolutely. That when you ask me how I reconcile it, if you have a judgment against an offending insurance company, 23 applies, and it can only be taken out pursuant to that statutory limitation. The only other way to do it is say, well, 23 says it can only be taken out of reserve. That must mean that the legislature really didn't know what they were doing when they enacted the definition of person. They really didn't know what they were doing when they reenacted the definition of person. And they really didn't know what they were doing when they took out company or companies out of Section 16.
All those things are possibly true.
I don't know where that's listed under the accepted rules of statutory construction, but they may be the real rules of statutory construction.
Am I correct? There's two federal cases and one state case that have looked at this precise point before us?
Judge, but there was one case they didn't sign.
You just mentioned a federal case.
Yes,
I thought you mentioned a name, and I don't see it anymore.
Well, there's one they did not sign, which is Haynes versus National Union Fire, 812 Federal Sub 93, which says, under Texas law, agent may be liable for misrepresentations to insured and for certain deceptive trade practices. That Southern District of Texas judge cited Gross versus State Farm, and Gross versus State Farm is 818-908, quote, thus when State Farm's agent misrepresented coverage, that misrepresentation made her individually liable, and that statement was also a misrepresentation by State Farm that made it liable as well, citing Royal Globe. That's at page 912. But I'll do a list with explanatory parens, no real argument, and just get that over as soon as possible.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
May it please the court, I feel somewhat at a disadvantage because I've heard a lot of cases thrown around that were not in respondents' brief. But if I can try to address those that I recognize, I'll do so quickly. The Light versus Wilson case that was cited is a DTPA case, which Justice Spears, in a concurring opinion, argued that the court should make it clear that individuals can be liable under the DTPA case, and therefore arguing for an overruling of this court's opinion in the Carl and Kelly case. To my knowledge, the Carl and Kelly case has never been overruled, but the point is that all that line of cases has to do is whether or not an individual employee can be liable under the DTPA, which this court, under Carl and Kelly, is saying no. But we don't deny that individual agents can be liable for, under common law, for fraud or intentional misrepresentations, etc. What we are arguing, however, is that Article 2121, Section 16 does not provide such a cause of action against the employee in his individual capacity. And we go back to the language that defines person and modifies it to be only those individuals or entities that are engaged in the business of insurance.
Well, what business is he engaged in? I don't understand you're making a
very well,
point
Your Honor.
Of that phrase removing the agent from...
It's our position that Mr. Garrett is not personally engaged in the business of insurance.
What business is he engaged in?
He's in the business of his employer. In other words, when you go to deal with Mr. Garrett, when an individual comes in to buy something and deals with Mr. Garrett, they are really dealing with Liberty Mutual Insurance Company acting through Mr. Garrett. They purchase a policy through that's issued by Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. They do not purchase anything that is sold by Mr. Garrett. So he is engaged in Liberty Mutual's business of insurance, but he is not individually engaged in the business of insurance.
Mr. Drammen, on following your reasoning, you put a gloss of a sort of a contractual arrangement between the parties. And since Garrett is only contracting on behalf of his employer, that's the only place the contract goes. But the definition includes adjusters. Ordinarily, adjusters would not have, even if they were independent of the insurance company, they would not have some sort of contractual arrangement with, their contract might be with the insurance company, but it wouldn't necessarily be with the insurer. So
that is sometimes correct. Well, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt. That is sometimes correct, but sometimes incorrect. Insureds will sometimes have significant self-insured retentions. They will hire adjusting agencies or adjusters to help them adjust their claims under their self-insurance program or under their self-insurance retention, or they will hire third-party administrators. You can still give legal meaning to and effect to the word adjusters consistent with the position that we're taking in this particular case. Although you are correct, sometimes adjusters are employees of the insurance company. There isn't that direct contractual relationship. But certainly when you talk about agents and brokers, often insureds will go to independent agents who are their agents in helping them buy insurance policies. And they have a contractual relationship with the independent agency that's helping them obtain insurance. There you have a contractual relationship. Again, that's not involved in this particular case. We have a neat set of facts here where the defendant is an employee of an insurance company, but certainly.
What if you're a life insurance counselor, but you're an individual? How do you square that with Section 23?
If you are a life insurance counselor, but you're in business on your own because you're a self-proprietor, then one can still be consistent with this contractual requirement and impose the contractual requirement and say that there could be a suit against that individual as a business, separate business entity, as a sole proprietor, as a life insurance counselor. Or if he's an employee of an independent group of life insurance counselors, then you could have a contractual relationship with that group that he is an employee of, that's a life insurance counselor group. What we are saying is that you have to have that contractual relationship.
But if you're a life insurance counselor and you're a sole proprietor, you don't really have capital of an insurance company within the meaning of Section 23, do you?
That's correct, and that's why it's not necessary for this court to make a decision about that, because I recognize the troubling interwoven or the relationship between that and Section 23. But clearly those provisions can be consistently construed here where the defendant is an employee of an insurance company.
If you get a judgment against a life insurance counselor who's a sole proprietor, how do you enforce it in light of Section 23?
Well, I don't honestly know. I mean, if this court is to permit a suit under Article 2121 against a life insurance counselor who is a sole proprietor and a sole individual, I don't know how he satisfies the judgment under Section 23 if you limit it to the capital surplus of an insurance company, because obviously he doesn't have that. That's why certainly Section 23 is difficult to reconcile, but it has remained on the books since 1985, even after the legislative changes pointed out by Mr. Mike. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take it.